In the opening verses of John's Gospel, it is written, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." In a world in which so many voices and conversations offer a great deal of heat but little light, your friends at 1517.org invite you to explore its podcasting network of 20 different shows. Do you have an interest in Christian history? Then Christian History Almanac will surely interest you. This five-minute podcast consists of stories from the past about men and women, saints and sinners all, who helped shape the great tradition of Christianity. The show is brief, always concludes with a moving piece of prose or poetry, and most importantly, a reminder that everything is going to be okay. Are you looking for meaty conversations on theology, the movers and shakers of church history, and Christian apologetics? If so, check out the original show, The Thinking Fellows, going on 7 years now. The fellows are sure to hold your interest. Perhaps you are looking for smart and engaging studies of the Bible. Then check out 30 Minutes in the New Testament or 40 Minutes in the Old Testament or both. These and a host of other 1517 podcasts are all available across every major podcasting platform, as well as at 1517.org. That's 1517.org. In each and every case, you will receive not only engaging talk, but most importantly, you will receive Christ Jesus, the crucified and risen Savior, Christ Jesus, the light of the world. The freak out over the Rittenhouse verdict and the rampant, ever more brazen shoplifting spree in California. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zan de Sanctis, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Youth Podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Moink and Headspace. More about them in due course. If you listen to this podcast on nationalreview.com, we're delighted to have you, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed at any of the streaming services out there, from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim Garrity, we got a big verdict in the Rittenhouse trial on Friday. The jury was out for several days, which led to speculation that it might be a hung jury. There might be some sort of horse trading going on in the jury that would lead to an unsatisfactory compromise verdict. Instead, we got these clean not guilties on all counts. Immediately, you had folks on the left saying this was a stinging indictment of the American system of justice that has been distorted by racism and the legacy of 1619 since the very beginning of this country. What do you make of it?
When we last discussed the Rittenhouse case on this podcast, I had emphasized that I didn't really know what was going to happen, that, you know, my lesson from the O.J. Simpson case was to not ever think you're seeing the same trial that the jury is seeing. The juries can surprise you. You can't tell what's going on in their heads. You can't tell what's going on in the deliberations in the jury room. So I tried to go into it with minimal expectations one way or the other. Lots of folks whose judgment I trust, including Andy McCarthy and Robert Verbruggen. We've had a bunch of folks on National Review really, you know, covering this trial inside and out. They certainly made it sound like the prosecutor was not having a lot of good days. And in fact, I think the moment that jumped out at me was when the prosecutor aimed the rifle in the courtroom with his finger on the trigger, which you're never supposed to do. That struck me as almost a desperate theatricality on the part of the prosecutors, trying to almost frighten the jury into feeling like they were potential victims of Rittenhouse and that this would spur them to a guilty verdict. The other thing I'd heard about, which you may remember from, it seems like a similar phenomenon in a lot of these high profile, politically charged court cases, was the argument about whether Rittenhouse was overcharged, that whether you could have a more likely, you had a better chance of persuading a jury if you charged him with other lesser charges. But in fact, it was first degree of every one of them. And it was, you know, the whole bunch of people in Wisconsin and all across the country really wanted to see Kyle Rittenhouse fry for what he did. And that, by golly, you couldn't possibly charge him with a lesser charge, even if you thought you had a better chance of getting a conviction, because people really wanted to see him nailed to the wall. Well, the prosecutors gave it their best shot. It did not shake out correct. It didn't shake out that way. I wasn't shocked by it. I think I was more shocked by other people's reaction to it and how much this turned into an all-consuming national rage fest and debate on Friday afternoon, turning into Friday evening, and really all through the weekend. So, and we'll talk a bit more about that national reaction, I think, a bit later. But I wasn't shocked by it. My attitude was very much like what the president, very lucid after anesthesia, had said, which was that the juries, that he had a fair trial, the jury system worked. And, you know, if you think Kyle Rittenhouse did not act in self-defense and that he should have been convicted of murder, okay, I hear that. I can understand that. That's the way a lot of people feel about O.J. Simpson. There's no guilt. Juries are the best system to determine guilt or innocence. That doesn't mean they're perfect. They can make the wrong decision. Sometimes they convict an innocent man. Doesn't happen that often, but it can happen. And sometimes a guilty man walks free because the prosecutor could not meet that threshold. You know, first degree murders are very tough to prove, particularly when there's a counter argument of self-defense. That's how things shook out. I was, you know, I saw the news, went, huh, and went about my Friday evening, but apparently a lot of folks could not put their feelings aside and move on with their lives.
Yeah, Suzanne, on the trial itself, it was just very notable in the closing arguments. You had both the prosecution and the defense playing the same videos, and the prosecution was making the case that Rosenbaum, the first assailant of Rittenhouse, was really, really was really far away when Rittenhouse shot him, which just was, you looked at it and you're like, what is he talking about? You know, he's trying to make 4 feet seem far away when Rosenbaum was lunging towards him and actually got gunpowder on his hand. So when the defense played that video and said, look, he's right on top of them, that was more convincing. And then the prosecutor tried to make the case that when Rittenhouse is walking away after shooting Rosenbaum and trying to surrender to the police, he's walking towards the police lines and is pursued by these folks who may or not have thought he's an active shooter. And you know, the guy hits him on the Huber, hits him on the head with the skateboard. He shoots him. And then Grosskurtz pulls a gun and is shot by Rittenhouse. The prosecutor tried to make a case with this really slowed down playing of the video that Grosskurtz was retreating because he did rock back on his heels. Meantime, while this frame by frame video is playing, you see everyone else in the picture basically moving like 10 or 15 feet out of the way and away from Rittenhouse. And Rittenhouse looks at some of these people and doesn't do anything. He doesn't shoot them. He doesn't point their gun at them because they're clearly retreating, whereas Grosskurtz is not. And then the defense plays the video and points out, well, Grosskurtz is pointing a gun at him. Rittenhouse, when everyone else is walking away, Rittenhouse doesn't shoot anyone else. He just shoots Grosskurtz. And this just seemed, you could look at these videos in 10 minutes and basically have the right take on this case. And it took the jury, understandably, more than 10 minutes, but they came up with what seemed obviously the right answer.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that they made the right decision. And I think that was pretty clear all along for anyone who's been following this and looking at it, trying to understand what actually happened. I think it's very clear Kyle Rittenhouse did not go there intending to or wanting to murder anybody. And if you pay attention to, or if you remember back to, and I guess it's still happening, take a look at the narrative we've seen surrounding this. It's very clear that he never did anything wrong because the narrative has been full of lies. And we saw it in part from the prosecution, but the argument has been, well, he's white supremacist. There's zero evidence of that. He went there with a gun because he wanted to mow down people. Also, primarily the argument goes non-white people. No evidence of that, nor is that what he did. He wasn't, the argument is he wasn't attacked. Well, very clearly he was attacked and this was an act of self-defense. And so the whole, there's been this construction around it as if he was there to kill people, as if he was there because he was some, you know, trying to enact some twisted idea of his racism on people. Now, I don't think that he should have been there. I don't think it was a good idea to go into that conflict the way that he did or into the place where he did and with a gun. But I don't think that he did it to murder people. And he, in fact, didn't murder anybody. And so I think that the right decision was reached. And the fact that we're seeing so many lies surrounding it and so many attacks on him that simply aren't true just tells you people wanted him to fit a particular narrative. They wanted him to sort of confirm their suspicions or confirm the points they want to make about white people hating people of other races. And so that's what they've done, even though the story doesn't conform to that mold at all.
So Charlie, in the wake of the verdict, self-defense has been on trial. You've had people saying, oh, self-defense. We all know what self-defense means. Self-defense means that white people get to shoot black people and get off. And that's the way it's always been in this country.
I think the reaction to this case on the left has been appalling. And I think it's been appalling in two discrete ways. It's been softly appalling from people who didn't follow this case and have no idea what happened. And there are a great number of them. They didn't watch the trial. They didn't examine the evidence. They didn't look at the charges. They didn't study the law. And so they have been fed a false account and are reacting to that rather than to reality. But then there are the people whose reaction has been hard, appalling. People who did or had watched the trial, but who fundamentally don't believe in our system of justice. A good number of people said this shows we need reform, need to start over. Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, said this. Colin Kaepernick, hero of Nike, said this. Bill de Blasio said this. Pretty much everyone on MSNBC said this. They said the system is set up to do this, but they never specify quite what they mean. Set up to do what? Which part of it, I would like to know, do they object to? Which bit will go in a reform if we start over? The presumption of innocence? Is that the part that's to blame? The right to remain silent? Double jeopardy? Cross-examination? Juries? What are they going to replace this system with? They never say. And I think one of the reasons they don't say is that they know that the system they have in mind would appall 95% of people, not just in America, in the world. Andrew Sullivan pointed out, you simply cannot have critical race theory, or wokeism, or racial essentialism, and a system of justice. You can't have those things along with individual rights either. You cannot have a trial that looks at individuals and that looks at facts that pertain to those individuals and want a politicized outcome along racial lines. And after the verdict came down, a friend texted me that paradoxically, given the reaction, that the result, the reaction, in a sense, showed him how Jim Crow happened and was sustained. That is, it shows that the urge toward collective guilt, as perceived by each person, is perennial. That there is no difference between, and of course this did happen, there are many great novels about it, between looking and saying, well, I assume that guy did this because the color of his skin is black, because he belongs to a group I dislike, because the political narratives around him are uncomfortable for me. There's no difference between that and saying, this man, Kyle Rittenhouse, got off and he was white. Therefore, you either believe in a system in which individuals are entitled to rights under the Constitution and are entitled to be judged based on discrete facts by a jury of their peers, or you don't. And I think it has been alarming and illuminating to learn how many people don't. And the last thing I will say here is I understand that if you're in the media, you're unlikely to be chosen to serve on a jury anyway. But there are a whole host of people who share our profession who should instantly, immediately, summarily be disqualified from jury duty because they have announced over the last week that they would be incapable of fulfilling that responsibility.
Yeah, Charlie, per the point that they really want a different kind of justice system, what they want is what they've gotten more or less, you know, with a lot of blowback in the legal system and the Trump administration rolled it back. Maybe we'll see that they're going to reverse that rollback. But is what we see on campus in sexual assault cases, where the accused in sexual assault cases on many campuses the last 4 or 5 years has just been assumed to be guilty, just by nature, by definition, to be guilty of a status offense. And every single procedural protection that we've developed over centuries in Anglo-America has been tossed aside. You know, every aspect of our adversarial system has been weakened in order to tilt the playing field against these presumed, you know, class and gender enemies. I mean, that if they could, that's what they would create in our
And community. Sometimes they are open about that. Figures such as Ezra Klein have written openly and said, look at the aggregate history here. We need to shift that back.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how liberal societies work or can work. And one thing, just on a practical level, that baffles me about it is that if that were how things worked in the United States, who do they think would benefit? If we decided to give up on our system, and instead of looking at individuals to operate our justice system along caste lines, who do they think would prevail? It's still a majority white country. It's an appalling, self-destructive way of looking at the law that could only lead to a much, much worse country than the one we live in.
Yeah, and you also, you can't overemphasize the radicalism of this. I mean, trial by jury, what, did the Normans bring it over, you know, to England when they invaded? I mean, it really goes back almost to the mists of time in Anglo-America. And then it's also just not true as a day-to-day practical matter that every white person that asserts self-defense gets off and black people don't. Glenn Greenwald pointed out that the same day, Friday, that we got the Rittenhouse verdicts, there was a cop in Missouri who pursued, he and his partner pursued a black guy in error and confronted him and shot him. And the cop's argument was that he was under threat. And the judge said, no, you're wrong. You're guilty here. You're the aggressor. And it was your duty to retreat. There was also, I believe, in Central Florida, a case involving a guy who shot at a SWAT team that showed up at his house. He says unannounced. The SWAT team says they did announce. And the judge or jury down there said, it's understandable. You shot in self-defense. Now, they got him on a weapons charge. He's apparently involved in the drug trade at some level. But anyway, it's just not the case that self-defense is solely a white thing. So, Jim, how do you read the fact that, you know, we all saw this late last week on Twitter, and it showed up in some TV news reports as well, just the rank misinformation about this case. People saying that he shot three black people on Twitter. At the same time, you know, we've had a national obsession with this case for 2 weeks, where if you paid 5 minutes of attention, you would know. There's the thing that's become parodic and a target of mockery by the right, which is that he went over state lines, carried a gun over state lines, when he just didn't. You had people saying his mother drove him there that night, which she didn't. And it's just on and on. Is this just people not paying attention, or people wanting to see the world through the prism of their ideological predispositions?
Rich, I think it's a little bit of both. And I think you accurately assessed an important point here, that we've had a national obsession about this case for probably about 2 weeks. But the trial has been going on a lot longer than that. that didn't just start all of a sudden. In fact, the incident occurred last summer. And while some folks, yes, really were, you know, heavily invested in this and paying attention from the beginning, my suspicion is that most of the people who were opining the loudest on cable news and social media and all that stuff over the last couple of weeks did not actually pay much attention to it. And to emphasize my point from last week, if you're just watching news coverage of the trial, you are looking at a news organization attempting to summarize an entire day's worth of testimony and arguments back and forth into a couple minutes. Well, some of these, you know, undoubtedly, if you summarize things that quickly, you're going to leave some stuff out. What's left out might be something that really mattered to those jurors, and it just didn't seem important enough to the person covering it. The other thing is that I think that we have this very racially charged template of how these things shake out. And the funny thing is how much, no matter how much people go back and try to revise the facts or reassess things, people don't people never want to go back and change their first impression. Shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, right? Eric Holder's Justice Department took a look at that and chose not to press charges against the cop, determined that there was not sufficient evidence to bring federal charges. George Zimmerman down in Florida, right? Now that was another good example of what I was discussing earlier of maybe the prosecutors overcharged. Maybe they would have had either a better chance of either persuading Zimmerman to plead guilty to a lesser charge, or they might have had an easier time persuading a jury of a lesser charge. But when there's this much, you know, emotional public anger surrounding these cases, the prosecutors are afraid of looking weak. They're afraid of looking like they gave somebody a soft deal when the public was so outraged. So instead, they swing for the fences. And when you swing for the fences, sometimes you hit a home run, but sometimes you strike out. And I suspect that's what's happening. And I get the feeling there are a lot of prosecutors in this country who would rather have the jury come back with a not guilty verdict and let the jury take the blame. And in this case, in Wisconsin, let the judge take the blame rather than the prosecutors, for exercising their own due diligence, their own judgment to say, you know what? There's no way we're getting murder one charges to stick on this guy. The evidence just doesn't support it. There's just too much reasonable doubt. If we charge this lesser charge, maybe there's a chance a jury would believe us. I think there's just this cycle. In the end, it's like it's prosecuting scared. Prosecutors are scared of using their own judgment and telling the public something they don't want to hear. And that is kind of at the core of all of this controversy, which is to say, you know what? You have this instant narrative of crazy, angry, racist white kid running through the streets of Wisconsin City, gunning people down. And, you know, many people believe, oh, it must be racially charged. He must be shooting black people. And the sheer number of people who said the police incident in the beginning that started all this involved killing a guy. No, he wasn't killed. It was just this. There's people jump to the storyline that they prefer in their heads. But it's not what happened. The other thing which is fascinating about this is that people get so emotionally invested in how their belief of how things must have shaken out that they do not want to, that they can't change. I've never heard anybody of those CNN commentators or anybody else say, I stand corrected. There really was no hands up, don't shoot in Ferguson, Missouri. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never seen anybody go back and say, I got that wrong. Or the fact that Eric Holder's Justice Department did not press charges strongly suggests that no, I don't think Eric Holder is in on the conspiracy. I don't think Eric Holder is a big defender of white supremacy. You know, that seems like a safe assumption there. So you add all up this stuff. People are just so wedded to the narrative in their heads, in which their side is the good guys, their side is the victims, the other side is all horrible, demonic, evil people. That even when the courts come out with it, that's why, one, they're shocked. They don't absorb any media. They don't listen to an Andy McCarthy type saying, actually, no, prosecutors run into a lot of trouble in this case. But two, I guess, and all the other things also, the reaction we saw on Friday night, some people enjoy a decision like this because it allows them to get angry. I think there's something cathartic about it. I think it says, the system is as bad as I always thought it was. It couldn't possibly be that their assumptions about what was going on in the case was wrong from the beginning.
So, Zan, I think another thing that's been notable here is the juxtaposition of the reaction to this case to the argument over CRT, where you've had basically all Democrats and a lot of figures in the media saying, oh, critical race theory, what are you talking? Why are you obsessed with this? This isn't out anywhere in the real world. It's just an academic theory reserved for law schools and, you know, Harvard classes and all the rest of it. But then you've seen the reaction to this verdict. The premises of CRT, you know, one of its holdings is that seemingly racially neutral proceedings and racially neutral outcomes aren't really racially neutral. There's a hidden structure of racism behind it. And that's been totally the take of most people on the left with regard to this case, including, you know, top level politicians. So Biden did say, and I do think, you know, having been in politics for 40 or 50 years, there's part of him that has deeply absorbed our norms and knows the president of the United States should say, well, this I respect the verdict. But then, you know, his staff writes this more woke written statement for him. You have Kamala Harris saying the verdict shows how much further we have to go as a country. You have Gavin Newsom saying similar things. So these kind of poisonous notions have really seeped into the mainstream of the Democratic Party.
They really have. And it's so frustrating to hear this all the time. Oh, critical race theory is just a, you know, academic concept. Okay. And in a sense, that's true, right? But it has filtered into this kind of political worldview that infects the left from top to bottom. Like, okay, no one's teaching, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw's articles to third graders in Loudoun County, but they certainly are teaching a view of American history that is totally infected by the principles of critical race theory and trying to turn everything into race, act like there's racism present or racial bias where there isn't. And the very fact that people, you know, like the people you named, Biden, Harris, other Democratic politicians would be talking about this verdict the way that they are, when, by the way, Kyle Rittenhouse did not shoot a non-white person. Okay, the people that he shot, not only, you know, set aside the whole self-defense thing, which is of course important, but even if he had, you know, just been willy-nilly killing people, they weren't Black people. And so the idea that we'd be talking about this as if it were an example of racial bias or racism or white supremacy or some kind of racial problem in America is insane. He didn't shoot Black people. You'd think if you hadn't been following the case or paying attention to what happened and you're just kind of drifting through some media coverage and trying to get the top line information, you would think that he had shot Black people, frankly, because of the way that people are talking about this. And I think that's grossly irresponsible, because if there were a problem of this kind of race-based violence, which I don't happen to think there is to the extent that the left claims there is, but if there were, probably we wouldn't want to be conflating instances that aren't those with ones that are, because that would be, you know, detrimental to solving the problem, you would think. And I think it's just another example, unfortunately, of this tendency over the last, I guess, a year and a half now on the left to act like everything is about race and to think that that's going to solve their political problems. And I can tell them it's not going to, right? When your reaction to the Virginia gubernatorial outcome, for example, is to say, oh, this is proof of racism among Virginia voters, when higher than usual levels of non-white voters supported Republicans, and two of the three Republicans who won statewide office were non-white people, that's insane, right? You're pushing a narrative that makes no sense, and most people will see right through it.
Charlie, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, the way that they get around what Alexandra just said is they transmute the two people who were killed and the one person who was injured from being white people into being Black allied or defenders of Black lives. And there is a real naivety at work here on the left that we have also seen when discussing Antifa. That if somebody is putatively on the right side politically, or is engaged in an activity that can be cast as being liberating, that they can't possibly have done anything wrong. And you see this, of course, with Antifa. What could be wrong with Antifa? It means anti-fascist. And then they point to the Americans and Brits, Canadians who stormed the beaches of D-Day. Well, there's a great deal wrong with a lot of people involved in Antifa. And there was a great deal wrong with many of the people who rioted last year. And we know for a fact, not that it should have had any bearing on the self-defense claim, and not that they deserve to die for it, but we know that there was a great deal wrong with at least one of the people who died at Kyle Rittenhouse's hands. And they can't see it. And so they move from generic claims into almost hero worship. And we're now seeing the lionizing of these rioters purely because they were, again, putatively involved in a cause of which the speaker agrees. But again, that is not how criminal justice can work. It's not how it should work. It's not how anyone would want it to work in practice.
So, Charlie, let me stick with you one last question on this. So some of the more reasonable sounding critics of the verdicts, what they'll say is they won't go necessarily to the CRT kind of racial essentialist arguments. They'll say instead, well, this really shows these open carry laws create a big problem because you have lots of people carrying guns and you're carrying a gun. So you're worried when someone else points a gun at you, or you're worried that someone's going to come take your gun away from you. And it creates this kind of Mexican standoff situation coupled with stand your ground laws. And you put this together and you get a really combustible situation. And that's what you saw on the streets of Kenosha. And that's going to be what we see elsewhere unless we fix these laws.
Well, I need to break that down. Stand your ground did not factor in here.
Because he didn't stand his ground. He ran, right, until he was...
Well, stand your ground... The purpose of a stand your ground law is to ensure that somebody who is claiming self-defense is not asked to prove something after the fact outside of the heat of the moment that is unreasonable. So, for example, if I am being threatened and I believe my life is being threatened and I shoot somebody who is threatening my life, I cannot, after the fact, be told that my self-defense claim is insufficient because I could plausibly have run away. Stand your ground is broadly misunderstood by its critics. It comes out of a 1970s, 1980s prosecutorial culture that was in the calm of the courtroom, demanding the sort of foresight and reflection that no one in the presence of an upturned knife could possibly have exhibited. But stand your ground here doesn't count, because if you look at the circumstances in which Rittenhouse fired his gun, he was under attack or on the floor. Yes, during the intermediary periods, he ran away, but there was no path for exit. So that doesn't come into it. So then the question is open carry. I think that there are prudential questions around open carrying, although I'm not particularly given to entertain them during a riot. Historically, though, open carry has been the norm in the United States for almost all of its history. It's concealed carry that has been more heavily regulated and more controversial. I believe I'm right in saying 45 states have open carry laws on the books. Texas became the 45th, having dropped it during Jim Crow. The ones that don't are Florida and South Carolina, both historically as a Jim Crow measure. California, which did up until the late 1960s, but Governor Ronald Reagan spearheaded its prohibition after the Black Panthers started doing it. New York, which obviously has strict gun laws, many of which are rooted in anti-immigrant sentiment in the early 20th century. And Illinois, which again has strict gun laws, largely because of Chicago. You can open carry in Maine, Connecticut, Oregon. You know, this is not novel. It is not a modern invention. It's not a practice that was invented by Antonin Scalia or the NRA. And this jump that we often hear in the press to look at our novel, crazy gun laws is just wrong. We, in fact, are accustomed to seeing people open carrying, even in states where open carry is illegal, during riots. If you think back to the Los Angeles riots of the early 1990s, the rooftop Koreans were famous for going out there and making it clear that if anyone came near or tried to damage their property, they would respond. So again, I think that the question in this case, was strictly factual. It was, did Kyle Rittenhouse act in self-defense? And more specifically, it is, was Kyle Rittenhouse guilty of 5 first-degree charges? First-degree charges that imply premeditation and intent. And when people focus on other things, race, political ideology, our gun laws, they miss the point. The jury did not miss the point, which was that Rittenhouse was overcharged and that the fact pattern did not tally with the prosecution's case, and frankly could not have tallied with it, given that Rittenhouse was charged 2 days after the incident, before the facts were known, before an investigation had been done, and before anyone involved had calmed down. So, you know, we will at our peril make this into a broader question in our society. It wasn't one. It was a question of discrete facts, and it came out, I think, correctly because there was a mismatch between those facts and what the state tried to demonstrate.
So it's been conventional wisdom that Rittenhouse shouldn't have been there. And I agree with that. 17 years old, he shouldn't have been out of the streets that night. But that doesn't mean that people shouldn't defend their property. You mentioned, Charlie, the Korean proprietors in the midst of the LA riots. Dave Bernstein of George Mason Law School had a great article about this a while ago on self-defense in light of the 2020 rioting, just went through all these examples of people, because the police weren't there, because the police weren't able to impose and maintain order, had to go out and defend their own property and businesses. And that's entirely right and just. So, exit question to you, Jim Garrity. Are you more encouraged by the Rittenhouse case since the facts and the law ultimately prevailed, or alarmed because the charges were brought in the first place and we've had this reaction since the verdicts?
Very slightly encouraged, in part because when it took a couple of days, you didn't have to, you could throw a stone and hit a conservative who thought, oh, the jury's talking themselves into it. They're afraid of riots. They're afraid if they rule the wrong way, they're going to, you know, if they rule them innocent, that they're going to be, you know, riots in the streets. And in fact, they reached encouraged that there was, that they reached the verdict they did. I'm encouraged that there really weren't any riots and we didn't see Wisconsin burning down, at least, you know, because of this verdict. So, no, I think the jury spoke and I think justice was done.
Zan, encouraged or alarmed?
I think I'm encouraged, more encouraged than alarmed, although a lot of the reaction and just frankly flat out lying surrounding it was very discouraging. But in terms of the verdict, I'm encouraged that it went the way that it did.
Charles C.W. Cook.
I'm encouraged. I don't just mean this personally, although as you've noted before, I have an investment in the defense because my personal horror would be being accused of something I hadn't done. But philosophically and much more broadly in the United States, I would consider it to be an example of profound decline if the pathologies that are on display in many of our elite institutions and especially in the media and academia had worked their way down to juries. And they haven't, or at least they didn't hear. This was a wonderful example of why we have juries in the first place, rather than trial by judge or trial by experts. And I am proud, if that's an appropriate word, of this jury, for despite being obviously nervous. I think one of the jurors thanked a police officer when he put the shield up in front of them once again. Despite being nervous, did its job soberly and seriously. So I am hopeful as a result of this.
So I'm with Jim. I would say slightly encouraged. I mean, it was a great relief that the jury came back with a just verdict. in this case, but I don't think the charges should have been brought in the first place. I think the reaction is really alarming. I just think, I mentioned these campus tribunals earlier, it's much easier to distort a process like that than to really distort the heart of our criminal justice system. That's going to be much harder for them to do, which doesn't mean they're not going to try to do it. With
Rich, that, before we move on, may I just say one more thing on this? Because I've seen some conservatives, most notably J.D. Vance, saying that this trial was worthy of a banana republic. And when pushed, their view seems to be that because the prosecutor overreached, because the charges were brought, that this shows some sort of decay in the United States. And I think the opposite is true. Constitutions cannot prevent prophylactically bad behavior. The fact that we have a constitution is testament to our knowledge that governments, prosecutors will behave badly. You judge constitutions and laws by what happens after that bad behavior. Does the bad behavior get struck down? Is it stopped? Is it limited? And in this case, admirably, the answer was yes. Despite the prosecution's overzealousness, the judge and the jury did their jobs. And I think that shows that we're anything but a banana republic.
Yeah. One last point on this, actually, just a smaller matter. Cameras in the courtroom, I've always been against it. You know, I don't think they should be in the Supreme Court, but I'm really mixed, and maybe after this trial, I think I'm wrong. It's true that people were reacting to the media, including the judge by the end, you know, reading criticisms in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and responding to them. That was really disturbing. But we wouldn't have known nearly as much about this case if we hadn't been able to watch it with our own eyes. And I think that's a really important thing. So with that, it's finally time in this podcast for our first sponsor. And we're going to go to you, Charlie, is arguably, although you got competition from the incomparable Sarah Schutte, arguably the biggest Moink fan on this podcast.
I am indeed the number one Moink fan on this podcast. Frankly, I don't think Sarah Schutte comes up to the level. Mm-hmm. And that's because...
Fighting words. Moink...
That's because, well, I don't know. Did Sarah Schutte have Moink last night?
I did not.
There we go.
But I would like to put in that while Charlie may be the biggest Moink fan, I probably can cook the meat better than him.
I
think that's true. I think that's true. Bro, I didn't cook it last night, though. My wife did a pork butt, and we had pulled pork. It was terrific. And that is because Moink delivers grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and wild-caught Alaskan salmon direct to my door and your door if you sign up, helping family farms become financially independent outside of big agriculture. Moink's animals are raised outdoors, their fish swim wild in the ocean, and Moink meat is free of antibiotics, hormone, sugar, and all the other junk you find prepackaged in the meat aisle. If you sign up at moinkbox.com/editors, you'll get a year of ground beef for free. And aside from that, you pick what meats you want delivered with your first box, and you can change what you get each month, and you can cancel anytime. I am a big Moink fan. We do this every single month. We've tried pretty much everything they do, and I love it all, although I'm particularly partial to the sausages, which are absolutely terrific. Moink was founded by an 8th-generation farmer who was featured on Shark Tank. The host of that show, Kevin O'Leary, said that it was the best bacon he'd ever tasted, and I agree. And Jamie Siminoff, the creator of the Ring video doorbell, also invested in Moink. So you too can join the Moink movement today by going to moinkbox.com/editors right now. And if you do, you will get free ground beef for a year for a limited time. That's spelled M-O-I-N-K box.com/editors, moinkbox.com/editors.
So, Zan, we had last couple of days this extraordinary spate of smash and grab, so-called robberies in the Bay Area, where dozens of people enter these stores and just take what they want and run. This comes against the backdrop of this ongoing spike in shoplifting in San Francisco and in other places around the country where shoplifting has been, at least it has in California, been downgraded as an offense. And if you steal less than, I think it's $950 worth of merchandise, it's a misdemeanor, and most misdemeanors aren't prosecuted. So people take it as a license to just go in and steal. There was a New York Times reporter who wrote a piece several months ago where he recounts going to a store in San Francisco and asking the clerk, so do you have to pay stuff for stuff or not in the city? Just because so many people were just walking out with merchandise. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't think it's really surprising at all. I don't know whose idea it was or why they thought it would be successful to turn theft under almost $1,000, by the way, into a misdemeanor. That is hardly nothing, right? If the policy is sort of aimed at, okay, people here and there can't afford food or something, and we're going to let things like that slide. Obviously, I still oppose such a policy. Not fair to the shop owners. You know, you're asking for problems if that's what you do. But then maybe it's under $50, right? Not $950. That's, you can go in and, you know, grab a nice new TV or two for that amount and just head out. And there's no reason why most people wouldn't do so. I think this is codifying essentially, you know, a policy or a worldview that encourages people to be the worst that they can be or to kind of cater to their base desires. The reason we have laws because it shapes what people think is good or right to do. And because it you know, imposes justice when they don't do what they should be doing. But first and foremost, because it tells people what our society thinks is acceptable. And so if you tell people, hey, if it's under $950, don't worry about it, that's what some large and increasing number of people is going to do. So I don't find it especially surprising. It's obviously very troubling. I don't know why anyone would want to live in a city where things like this are going on. I certainly wouldn't want to own or open a business there. I think they're headed for some kind of really big catastrophe. This obviously is a catastrophe in itself, but over the last few years, as far as I know, things are getting worse and worse. And I have to imagine they're going to have to, you know, pivot back in the other direction pretty hard sooner or later to fix this.
Yeah, Jim, there was an incident a month or two ago. I forget what the store was, but people came in with wire clippers and just took all these fancy handbags. I think it was two people, and they had like a big sack, if I remember correctly from the video, and just cleared out all these handbags. And what was extraordinary about it was all the clerks just were standing there. No one even objected. And according to the report in the immediate wake of this, no one at the store had even reported it yet. And that just gets to this terrible kind of demoralization of the civilized forces in our society, because the authorities no longer buttress civilized values.
Rich, it feels like a really vivid demonstration of the validity of the broken windows theory, which those of us who grew up in the New York City area will recognize. I believe it was Bratton, but really came into effect under Rudy Giuliani during his sane years when he was mayor. Basically, this idea of, for a long time, there had been this, crime is terrible in New York City, but you know, why are you wasting time with the squeegee men or something like that? You should be focusing on murders and rapes and violent crime. And all throughout the 70s and into the 80s, the Koch years, the Dinkins years, crime was still really bad in New York City. It seemed to be getting worse and worse. And there was this whole different philosophy of, if I'm remembering the metaphor correctly, if you see a broken window and it doesn't get fixed, eventually people start throwing stones through the other windows. If you see the window get fixed, people say, oh, okay, people care about this around here. There are consequences to breaking a window. I should not do that. But if people feel the signal that things are not, nobody cares, this doesn't matter, nobody's enforcing the law, there are no consequences, then people kind of start indulging their inner hooligan, inner mischief maker, inner criminal, bursts forth to the surface. And so New York City began this application. They started going out. First day of very early in Giuliani's term, they went after the squeegee men. And the thing that I love, the example I thought was so evocative and clarified so much of this, was turnstile jumpers. In the New York City system, it used to be very easy for, particularly if you're young and athletic, jump over the turnstile, you don't have to pay the token. And for a long time, the subway cops and NYPD didn't bother with it. It wasn't a big enough deal. A token was like a buck or something like that. But what they realized was, well, once you've seen somebody do a crime, the undercover cops, Well, then they can, you know, start patting them down. And you start patting them down. You start finding guys with knives. You start finding guys with drugs. You start finding guys with guns. And all of a sudden, now you've got them on not just on jumping the turnstile, but also on illegal weapons possession or something. And now you can really send them to jail for a while. And now all of a sudden you're getting people. So people suddenly started getting the signal. If you're going to jump, first of all, don't jump the turnstile. But even if you do, or if you do think you're going to be in a situation where you can get patted down, leave your gun at home. Leave your knife at home. Leave your drugs at home. And lo and behold, you had less drug use in the subway. You had less people. The number of shootings went down. All of a sudden, the recognition, oh, wait, the cops are checking people for this. We'd better not walk around with our guns and our knives and our drugs and all that stuff. It appears, we've seen this backing away from this from broken windows policing for a whole bunch of reasons. And I do think when you look at cases like the Garner case up in New York, having this broken windows theory with a nanny state government in which Garner ends up being, you know, tackled to the ground and ultimately strangled because he was selling loose cigarettes. Now, you know, Garner's not a saint, but on the other hand, I think everyone would agree he doesn't deserve to die for the crime of selling loose cigarettes without a permit. When you combine this, like, very, I don't want to say heavy-handed, but let's just say very aggressive enforcement of the law with the nanny state in which any little violation of the law does require the whole response of government, all of a sudden that's when you end up with a lot more conflict. So, but anyway, so we're seeing here in San Francisco, this is what happens when you say, ah, shoplifting isn't that big a deal. The stores can eat the costs of it. It's, you know, we're not going to bother with doing that. Well, then, you know, once you send the signal, we no longer worry about shoplifting, you get a whole lot more shoplifting. And you end up with this, this awful circumstance in San Francisco. I suspect a lot of big cities in this country, like haven't been to San Francisco in a long time, but, you know, for all of the bashing it gets from conservatives, it was, at least until there was poop on every street corner, it was a lovely city. It was beautiful, lovely weather, except when it was chilly, you know, other than those cold summers they have. Golden Gate Bridge, you know, Ghirardelli, chocolates. It was a great place. And I think you could apply this to a lot of California. This idea of, like, look, we're a great place to live. We don't have to worry about stuff like crime. We don't have to worry about cost of living. We don't have to worry about the quality of our schools. We're California. Everybody's always going to want to live here. Well, at some point, people begin to realize they don't need good weather if they're stepping in human poop all the time and they're watching shoplifters run amok in all of their favorite stores.
Yeah, Charlie. So this is a really an industrial scale operation. Kevin had a great piece for us, went out to San Francisco and pointed out that there are organized crime rings behind these thefts. And, you know, some warehouses and whatnot have been raided, and they found, you know, $1.8 million worth of razors that have been stolen from various drugstores that are going to be resold on eBay or Amazon. And it has an enormous real world effect. You've had all these store closings in San Francisco, just outlets saying, you know, retailers saying, we can't afford to operate here if you're not going to protect us from this crime. And as is always true of disorder and rioting, it is the vulnerable neighborhoods and vulnerable people that pay the price, because they're the places where the outlets are most likely to close.
I don't think there is either a principled or a practical argument in favor of this policy. The principled objection is obvious. Shoplifting, stealing, is a crime because it's wrong. People who steal, whatever euphemism you want to use for it, are removing other people's property from their possession without permission. And that applies just as much to 95 cents worth of property as it does to $950 or $9.5 million, for that matter. There is no but. There is no but CVS has a lot of money, but the CEO makes this much, but they have insurance. It's wrong. Practically, it's lunacy. When I was a kid, I was perplexed by the signs on the entrance doors of many of the shops we used to go to. I remember particularly, there was a sign on the door of the Early Learning Center, which was a kid's store in Cambridge, England, which I love because it had a train in the corner that you could play with, that said, shoplifters will be prosecuted. And I asked my parents why that was there. Isn't that obvious? And they said, no. In the late 1970s in Britain, many companies and towns tried this experiment that San Francisco is engaged in. And it was a disaster. It would write it off. Look for the root causes. I know these boys. Well, it turns out that when you encourage people to steal, when you turn a blind eye to stealing, you'll get more of it. And by the mid to late 1980s, towns and businesses had had enough. And they started pressing charges, both civil charges and criminal charges, against people who took things, even if it was just a pack of chewing gum or just a book. And I think that speaks to something core within and ineluctably true about conservatism, that you cannot abolish human nature and you cannot abolish incentives. And what San Francisco has done quite consciously is set up a whole bunch of incentives, which perversely enough are serving as disincentives for everyone else who lives there.
Suzanne, next question to you. The backlash against urban disorder is coming. Indeed, is arguably already upon us. Yes or no?
I think it's coming. I don't think it's quite there yet, but you do see, you can't really know exactly why people are moving, but you do see higher rates of people moving out of states where things like this are happening to states where it's not. And I suspect some part of that is because of it, but I think it'll intensify a lot in the next few years.
Jim Garrity.
Yeah, I think you could argue the mayoral race in New York City is one of many examples, although I think it will move at different speeds at different parts of the country, and it'll probably come to San Francisco last.
Charlie.
I agree with Jim. It's worst in San Francisco. It's going to be fixed last. But we're certainly seeing a backlash against it. And the political backlash will be interesting. There are many, many reasons that the political map has changed and that Republicans don't win places like Illinois in the way they used to. But one of the reasons for it is that crime dropped so precipitously from the early 90s onwards that one of the attractive features brought by Republican candidates had disappeared from the matrix. And if this continues, it will return, and you'll start to see some surprising results around the country as people say, whatever my other politics, I am not standing for this.
Yeah, I think the answer is yes, it is coming and is already here. Eric Adams is the most prominent example, but you've seen indications in other cities around the country. This kind of disorder is just intolerable and won't be tolerated over the long run. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode, Headspace. Are your thoughts running in endless circles in your mind? Well, what if a few minutes was all it took to change your relationship with stress and anxiety, transforming your life for the better? That's the power of meditation with Headspace. Our thoughts can be confusing enough. Meditation doesn't have to be. Headspace is your convenient dose of meditation, mindfulness, and sleep exercises to relieve stress and anxiety and help you get a good night's sleep all in one app. Make it easy to catch your breath and make time for your mental health. And it's one of the most science-backed meditation apps in the world, proving meditation works. A study proves in just 2 weeks, Headspace can reduce your stress by 14%. Headspace makes it easy to learn and maintain a meditation practice that will improve your mood and help you feel happier. Once you download the Headspace app and use their meditation, mindfulness, and sleep exercises, it takes just a few minutes a day to change your relationship with stress and anxiety to start feeling better, from waking up happier to getting your mind ready for bed. With nearly 60 million downloads, the Headspace app is the most science-backed meditation app in the world, proving that meditation really works. Find some Headspace at headspace.com/editors and get 1 month free of their entire meditation library. This is the best Headspace offer available. So go to headspace.com/editors today to get that 1 month free from the entire meditation library. Again, headspace.com/editors, headspace.com/editors. Please check it out. So let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you are looking forward to Thanksgiving despite having to do some heavy duty driving in I-95 traffic, depending on what time you leave Wednesday morning.
You can almost take off the depending on what time you leave, unless we decide to you know, hit it at the crack of dawn. We're probably going to hit it at some point. Listeners out there, I hope you're having a wonderful Thanksgiving. And if you on Wednesday happen to find yourself on Interstate 95 heading north somewhere between Authenticity Woods, somewhere in the wilds of Fairfax County, Virginia, and say Bucks County, get out of the left lane, please. Because you know, it's bad enough when you have, you know, just a heavy volume. It's even worse when there's, you know, somebody who feels the need to go at the, you know, faster than the speed limit in that left-hand lane. Now, this is the first get-together for my family on Thanksgiving in 2 years because we had elderly relatives. We were worried about COVID last year. And it as I've lamented in the past, just wasn't the same. It feels like a really big deal. It's been a challenging year for some folks in my family. Everybody's doing okay so far. Knocking on wood, we have a bunch.
Are you doing any instant tests, or that's too crazy for you guys?
We're all shot twice, boosted up the wazoo. I think we're all okay.
They put mine in my arm.
Yeah, and, you know. By the way, where China was testing the visitors.
What was the FDA approval for that, Jim?
I had to pay extra. It's funny. We have been able to see these relatives at various points during the year, but this will be the first time we're all going to be together.
Conspiracy theories now about the boosters in the arms. Just imagine if they're up the wazoo.
So it's going to be great. But every year, the traffic the day before is really rough. Apparently, fewer people are traveling this year than in 2019. So maybe it won't be so bad. So if I seem really cheerful the next time we have this podcast, it means it wasn't terrible. If not, it's all of your fault, listeners, for not getting out of the left-hand lane.
Yeah, well, my principle, you don't travel anywhere on Wednesday or Sunday. Just bump it up a day. You know, do it on Tuesday. Head where you're heading on Tuesday and come back on Friday or Saturday. But that's whatever it's worth. I'm sure it'll be delightful. Jim, enjoy it. And Zan, you are already looking ahead. None of this just Thanksgiving stuff for you. It's already Christmas season and you are shopping for Christmas decorations here in late November.
I have been. And before I hear listeners hollering at me for doing this, I just wanted to make sure we got the basics, the wreath, the lights. Things sell out so quickly these days. You never know what you're going to be able to find. So we just went and did a first pass at the basics to make sure we had it. We're not decorating with it. The things have not been taken out of the boxes. They're just in the living room waiting for the Saturday after Thanksgiving when we will begin to decorate. And I will celebrate Thanksgiving and then I will embark on Advent in the correct liturgical order. But I will also be listening to Christmas music and decorating my house. So
that goes without saying it'll be in the correct liturgical order. You didn't need it.
Always.
That sounded way too defensive, Sam. So I was at a gardening store the other day. More about that in a minute. But if I overheard the chatter correctly, there was some folks tying a Christmas tree onto the roof of their cart. And I think the staffer was saying that was the first tree they had sold this year. So, Charlie, you had quite the adventure with a glass of wine and your five-year-old.
Yeah, I just want to congratulate my five-year-old, really, for the raw efficiency with which he threw a very large glass of wine over me two nights ago while we were sitting outside in what, to most people, would not seem cold weather, but here in Florida it seemed,
what was it,
at least a little bit, oh, it was something gassy, like 69. But we're sitting outside and my wife went and got this glass of wine and put it on the table, and I was sitting, I don't know, about a foot away, and he swung his arm beautifully, like Babe Ruth, swung his arm, knocked this glass of wine over. Now, it's bad enough to have a glass of wine thrown all over you, but sometimes you get away with it if it all lands in one place, one particular part of your body gets sodden. But my legs were under the table, and the table was one of those with holes in it. And so the wine spread out across the table perfectly and then filtered down onto my legs, covering every last part of my jeans, while the rest of it that went over the lip of the table created a sheet effect down my t-shirt. I've never seen anything quite like it. I was less sanguine about it than I sound now I'll admit. But, looking back, it really was a quite masterful.
This is your most detailed explanation of anything since the running the squirrel over incident.
Wow, this was more pleasant.
So I was positively bucolic yesterday. I planted bulbs. So I love spring flowers. I particularly love crocuses and daffodils. And I think I'm just getting under the wire here in terms of it getting too cold. But I had a couple bags. They didn't seem particularly big, but there was a lot of hole digging. So it was quite the workout. So Shuddy, Sarah, I'm sure that the Shuddy household must do some bulb planting at some point, right?
Yes, we do indeed. My mom is a very avid gardener. We have beautiful gardens. She does a lot of prep.
What kind of bulbs?
We've got gladiolas. We have tulips all over the place. Our crocuses come up naturally in the backyard. We didn't plant them. They just are there. We've got daffodils in the front flower bed. So yeah, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I love crocuses. We had some natural crocuses in the house I grew up in the front yard. And they're just great. It's the first harbinger of spring. Not really the first harbinger of spring. Actually, snowdrops come up earlier. But it's wonderful to see crocuses, and they always, you know, they come up and they die out really quickly. You know, there's a big snowstorm or whatever. They always come up too soon, but it's the first sign that winter is really loosening its grip. So it's that time in the podcast for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, Rich, it was almost you. I was so tempted. I was really there. And then as we were recording.
Thank you.
Dan McLaughlin posted the corner. I think it's a really good and useful point, making the observation. The title is "The Professional Resistance Desperately Wants Trump to Be the Republican Nominee in 2024." And Dan actually had sent me an email, you know, kind of discussing this before it went up, but he's observing the Lincoln Project is now running ads that are basically touting Ron DeSantis in an attempt to spur Donald Trump to run for president in 2024, kind of appealing to his jealousy, appealing to his ego, trying to make Donald Trump feel like he's being snubbed, he's being ignored, he's being looked past. And the interesting thing is, like, remember this group was like designed to stop Donald Trump? Remember the whole objective was to get Donald Trump out of office? And now their specific effort is to make sure Donald Trump runs again, I suspect, because it's really good for the Lincoln Project fundraising. I'm glad that Dan is calling this out. It strikes me as an infuriating turn of events. We have a lot of problems in this country. At the core of it is that a whole bunch of people want to make money a lot more than they care about the state of the country. And I think the Lincoln Project is right in that group.
Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece from a few days ago by MBD called "The Never Endemic Story." Michael has been, I think, a must read certainly throughout the pandemic on a lot of the craziness of all these restrictions we're dealing with. But I think this is his latest and a very important piece on how we need to shift from this always perpetual pandemic to something more livable.
So, Charlie, I hesitate to ask for fear that you actually might not have one, but what's your pick?
My pick's actually Jim's corner post, which I think is the main thing on the site at the moment. Joe Biden can't deter anyone. Jim always does a great service for me because he finds every example of whatever case that he's making. And so if I follow Jim's argument, which I often do, and start arguing myself, and someone says, well, what evidence have you got for that? I just go to the database that Jim has put up on the corner. And so what about this, and this? So Joe Biden can't deter anyone. In case you're wondering what that is about, it's about the president of the United States traditionally being able to throw his weight around on America's behalf on the world stage, but Joe Biden not being able to do that because he's, well, Joe Biden.
So my pick, it's been a while now, but I mentioned it earlier, is Kevin Williams's piece in the magazine on San Francisco and the shoplifting spree. Just classic Kevin. He goes somewhere, he gives you great color because he's actually there on the ground, and then incredible insight, profound insights in many instances, really eloquently expressed. And this piece was a foremost example of Kevin at the top of his game. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the aforementioned incomparable Sarah Schutte makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zan. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to Moink and Headspace. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.